CliffCentral.com.
All right, we're getting ready for the burning platform, which is next. But let me just tell you, if you've ever woken up profoundly disturbed by a dream and wondered what the hell it meant, well, maybe they don't mean anything. But if dreams occur as part of your regular sleep, maybe they do serve some purpose as part of normal bodily functioning. Well, you can find out a little bit more in a fascinating episode of Beyond Madness that features, of course, our brilliant Professor Christopher Paul Szabo, who is also a psychiatrist. He talks to smart people in the business, tries to figure out the best ways to make sense of what's going on in our heads, and that is Beyond Madness in proud association with Adcock Ingram OTC, the sponsors of Brave. That's happening today. You can download a brand new episode of Beyond Madness. And speaking of downloading episodes, I don't know if you've listened to our latest podcast series that we've done in association with Investec, but they've really put it together, and they are working so hard in various places to help the cause of sustainability. And I want you to hear about this from the actual clip. I'm not going to explain to you what it is. I want you to just hear this, and if this doesn't make you want to listen, then I don't know what will. But here's how it goes. This is episode 2, and there are already 3 episodes out. Listen to this.
Imagine for a moment that you're in the wilds of Southern Africa. You'd expect to hear birds, maybe the sound of a steady flowing river, and a breeze rustling the leaves of a bush willow growing along its banks. In a secluded area of Mpumalanga, South Africa, all these sounds can be found in abundance, along with some others you might have heard. Some you might not expect. And some you may not even recognize.
Now, amazingly, that sound you hear there is actually the sound of a baby rhino. And they've got the biggest orphan rhino sanctuary in Mpumalanga. And it's the most incredible story of how conservation there has taken a completely different turn. And you've got to listen to it. There's no other way for me to explain it to you. If you haven't heard of it, it is brand new. It's on cliffcentral.com. You need to take a listen. It's Future Impact, which we did with Investec. And we hear from founders and workers at the largest rhino sanctuary in the world on how putting people at the center of their conservation strategy has been key to their success. You want to take a listen to that? It's all available on cliffcentral.com. Go and check it out today. Right, it's time for the burning platform. Let's find out what we're up to this morning. And first of all, my co-host ever, Pumi Mashiho. It's good to see you, Pums. And for those people who come only for the burning platform, remember to subscribe and like and all that stuff. Otherwise, I get into trouble. Subscribe and like and subscribe. You know how it goes. Do it today. Thank you very much. Also, our guest this morning is Ernst Roots. Hey, Ernst, nice to see you. Oh, hang on.
The show. Thanks for having me.
There we go. Right. So Ernst is the head of policy and action at the civil rights group AfriForum. He's also the chairperson of AfriForum's streaming service, AfriForum TV, and also the chair of AfriForum's think tank, OpenOR. In his free time, he plays the lead guitar in an Afrikaans metal band called Soms Wen Die Wolf, and is sometimes caught skateboarding. Yeah, you're not boring, Ernst. We can definitely say that. You've also spent quite a lot of time traveling in the last few years trying to explain what's going on in South Africa to people who might not know or people who are curious. And it's good to have you on the show this morning. Pumi and I had a whole bunch of questions for Barry Bateman the other day, and some of them I thought that the best person to answer some of these is probably you. So that was our first motivation for getting you on. But you've been doing a bit of a tour explaining what AfriForum's all about. So let's start off there. So that people who've never ever heard, what does AfriForum do? What is the reason that you guys exist? What is your main job inside of AfriForum? Give us the overview, the bird's eye view.
Yeah, so AfriForum is a civil rights organization. We function on members. So we recruit members, and members make a monthly donation to our work. And that's how we fund our activities. We are part of what is called the Solidarity Movement, which is a network of organizations which started around the trade union Solidarity. We were founded in about in 2006. And just a bit of a context as to why AfriForum was founded also explains what we are doing. So Solidarity is a trade union. It comes from the Christian tradition of trade unions. So when you think about trade unions, you typically think about a more socialist type organization. But there's also a tradition of trade unions that places emphasis on things like family and things like culture and responsibilities and so forth, and encouraging mm-hmm. people to work hard and stuff like that, as opposed to an emphasis on marching and striking and so forth. And as is the case with trade unions, usually is trade unions are involved with stuff that are broader than just labor-related issues.
Yeah.
And we've come to notice within Solidarity that, or they came to notice, I was only involved with the youth back then, that there are a lot of issues that need to be tackled, especially in South Africa. There's a wide sphere of things that need to be addressed that are outside the sphere of labor issues, so much that it would deflect attention, that it would shift the core focus. And so AfriForum was founded. And so the easy way to explain it, if people sometimes ask what's the difference between AfriForum and Solidarity, and the easy way to explain it is Solidarity focuses on your rights as a worker inside the workforce, and AfriForum on your rights outside the realm of labor-related issues.
Yeah, AfriForum have obviously made quite a lot of noise in some court cases recently, and it would be remiss of me to not at least dwell on those for a moment or two. When do you guys decide that it's worth taking up an issue? Because obviously legal costs are very high in South Africa. If you're doing it for shits and giggles because you've got millions of rands in the bank, that's a different story. Why do AfriForum, why do you choose certain cases and not choose others? And, you know, there are a lot of people who will cynically accuse you guys of just looking for attention in some cases. And in others, people will say, well, why are you even doing that? That's got nothing to do with your mandate. How does it work? How do you make those decisions?
Well, so firstly, in terms of how we operate, we have an agreement with a law firm, Herter Spies Attorneys. So they're an independent law firm. They do their own work, but they also have a contract with us. Mm-hmm. So we're in communication with them on a regular basis, as in every day. And how we decide which court cases to take on is we've gotten to a place now where it's pretty quick for us, easy for us to decide, because we know we've got a good sense in the organization of what are the type of cases that we take on and which don't we take on. Mm-hmm. But it depends on the nature of the case. We usually discuss it internally. If it's more urgent, we discuss it on WhatsApp. We have a meeting every 2 weeks on a Monday where we go through big court cases coming up and potential court cases. So usually we would discuss it there. It's an executive meeting. But there are some things that we have come to decide in terms of or agree on in terms of how we take on a court case. And one example is we often, very often, get sent screenshots or links of people inciting violence on social media, for example.
Right.
Then we would be asked to take them to court. And our approach, broadly speaking or generally speaking, is we don't take on individual cases. In other words, we don't go to court on behalf of a particular person who was discriminated against, unless that particular matter has far-reaching consequences, and taking that matter to court would have a wider impact on society at large. And when it comes to things like hate speech, our broad approach is we don't ask for court orders against people who have no political influence. So if there's some random guy who just wants attention on social media and he starts publishing hate speech, there's probably a reason to take someone like that to court. But our broad approach is if it's someone with significant influence, if it's someone with a large following, a leader of a political party or a member of parliament who incites violence, then it's a different matter. So broadly speaking, the question, one of the big questions for us is what would the impact of this case be? Is it a bigger impact type of case, or is it only related to a smaller type of incident?
What sort of membership do you guys have, Ernst? And And what kind of funding do you guys manage to get from those members? Because a lot of civil society initiatives, civil rights businesses, activist groups, whatever they might be, don't get to be as influential as you are. I mean, obviously, that's thanks to your members. How many people are we talking about here?
I'll get you the latest number, which was sent to me. Here we go. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, we had 304,459 members. So our approach is, and that's an important difference between AfriForum and a political party, is we are democratic, but we're not a political party in the sense that we have members getting together and then we have a conference and then the members decide what the policies are.
Yeah.
And members vote to change the policies and things like that. That's in theory how political parties work, even though in practice, not really. If the EFF votes to become a free market party, I'm sure that would not happen. So as an example, so our approach is different. We're a company. We're registered in terms of the Companies Act.
Okay.
We're an NGO, so it's a non-profit company. It used to be called a Section 21 company,
right?
Which means that we don't have shareholders. We don't pay out dividends. You can't buy shares in AfriForum or anything like that. The money that we get, we don't pay out to someone else. We use that money in our operations. And our approach is we decide what our policies are. Obviously, there's communication throughout with our members, so it's important for us to stay in touch with our members. We do polls. We speak with them regularly, daily, and so forth. And with our members, we decide what our policy positions are, and we campaign on that. And our approach is if you agree with what we are doing, you can join the organization. And it's worked out very, very well for us. We don't have any corporations, you know, funding AfriForum. We haven't gotten any money from government ever, and we don't want to accept money from government. We've worked on particular projects where someone would say, well, we want to be a sponsor for this particular project. So that happens sometimes when we would have, let's say, a festival of some kind and some local business would say, we want to sponsor this. So we do that. So we don't get zero money from other companies, but that's the exception.
I'm just curious, like 300,000, you know, a lot of people say that you guys are a very big player and you punch above your weight, but 300,000 by measure of the population is not a huge number of people. And it's true then to say that your influence is greater than your membership would betray. Pums, you must have some questions. I mean, we had quite a lot of overflow when we had Barry on the other day and stuff that you probably a better place to answer. So let's get straight into it. And then I do want us to look at some big international stories. I want to look at some of the big things happening in this country and hear your opinion on those too, Ernst and Pumi. Pums, over to you.
You know, I love that you're defined as a civic organization. And I'm quite interested to know what the ideal looks like for AfriForum. What does the ideal look like when South Africa is working and there is no longer a need for civic organizations? What does that look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we often say that if we succeed in our goals, then we would have to close AfriForum. So the ideal for an organization like us is that we want to close shop, that there's no need for us anymore, which obviously is idealistic, but it's something that you can work for. So the big thing for us in terms of the current situation in South Africa, and it's something that we have been pushing to an extent recently, and we're going to be pushing this topic much more in future, is the whole issue of federalism, or you could call it decentralization of power, or you can call it autonomy. And what we mean by that is we believe...
Or separate development.
Just say that again?
Or separate development.
No, it's not separate development. it's decentralization of power is not the same as separate development. Decentralization of power means that local communities have... the USA, for example, is a federal country. Switzerland is a federal country. So federalism. So Switzerland's a good example. If we go down the street today and we ask people who's the president of Switzerland, almost no one knows who the president of Switzerland is. But despite that, Switzerland is one of the most successful countries in the world. And I think that's part of the issue here. Most of the problems in South Africa currently can, as far as we are concerned, can be traced back to the fact that we have a central government with a lot of power over local communities with whom they are not in touch. They don't have a proper feeling for a lot of issues on ground level. And a federal system is one where you can have a central government, but there's more authority vested in local communities. For example, more authority in more power for the provinces as opposed to the central government. But then again, then also more power for municipalities. So I think part of one of the main issues also with the apartheid government or the central development system is that it had a very strong central government. And I mean, we've tried different forms of strong central governments in this country. But we're not anarchists in the sense that we believe there should be no government or there should be no state or anything like that. But our approach is that decentralization of power, in other words, less power for a president or a cabinet or a parliament, and more power for local communities to decide on issues themselves and also to decide how their tax money should be spent.
I think isn't that a kind of a trend that's happening worldwide, though, is this idea of devolution. You know, we see in many places that people want their local government to have more authority, more power, and take more control of the spending, because they're the ones that you interface with almost on a more regular basis than the national government. How often does the average South African actually deal with the national government? Obviously, in this country, too many times, which is why we've got issues around service delivery, and nobody really knows who to take that up with. If we actually knew our ward councillors, and Pumi and I talk about this often because we're all on WhatsApp groups and things, you know, the people who you know in your neighborhood should be the ones that you should be able to vote for. And they're the ones who should have the power to be able to make things better or worse, depending on what their mandate is.
Yeah, and the typical reality usually is you would speak to your ward councillor about an issue in your community, and they would often respond by saying, well, this is outside of my powers. I would have to take it to this particular meeting or to this. I would have to go to the provincial council or something like this, or there's some national legislation that prevents me from doing this. And you can, and obviously you should have national legislation, but I think that's part of the issue here, is that local governments do not have authority to intervene when they should intervene. And you're right, they are. It has been a trend recently. The world went through a weird stage, it seems like we're stepping out of it, where in the 90s there was a lot of talk about, you know, New World Order. Mm-hmm. There was that famous George Bush speech about I think the way he framed it was supplanting the law of the jungle with the rule of law. And what he meant by that was, well, we can debate on what he meant by that, but I think one of the consequences of that is this whole thing about sort of centralizing or standardizing on American Western ideas and trying to convince the rest of the world that they should be like the Americans or they should be like the West.
Yeah.
And that obviously failed spectacularly.
Completely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it seems to me that we're moving out of that mind frame now, which I hope is true. I hope my observation is correct. And there are some very interesting things coming up in terms of different forms of government. So one example we often refer to is the Tyroleans. So Tyrol is, or North South Tyroleans, as they call themselves. Tyrol used to be the north of Switzerland and Austria, a big part of Austria.
Yeah.
And now South Tyrol, as it is known, is actually the northern province of Italy called Alto Adige. But it's mostly German people living there, not Italians. So the Italians are actually a minority in that province. And so what the Tyroleans do is they have a you can call it an agreement with the Italian government that it's an autonomous province. And what that means is that particular province has because it's not entirely the same as the rest of Italy, it has different views.
But Ernst, I mean, this is where Pumi has a point about how it does tend to sound like, I mean, coming from your point of view at AfriForum, and this is what you guys get a lot of criticism for, is your interests are fairly narrow because this is a fair criticism, if you ask me, because you're representing your members and your members are largely Afrikaans speaking, and self-determination is only a few steps away from kind of the idea that you should be a separate entity entirely from the national government. I mean, we've seen people compare what you guys do to what they've tried to do in Oranje, for example. And while that's good or bad, and that's open to interpretation, there is this idea that, well, obviously AfriForum are going to take the view that, you know, a small community of people who are culturally similar and homogenous would want to govern themselves and almost completely become a satellite of the national government. And how possible is that, really? How practical is that in a country like South Africa? I mean, we often hear people saying the Western Cape is already a different country in some ways. Is there something wrong with the way we think? Is there something wrong with the way that they think? What's the line here? Because it seems a bit blurry. Right, Pums?
Yeah. Well, I think the only thing that would be more difficult than trying to give authority, some form of authority or some form of recognition to local communities, particularly including cultural communities, such as Afrikaners or Afrikaans-speaking people, if you want to use that as reference. Mm-hmm. The only thing that would be more difficult than achieving that is to try to make the current system work. The system that we're in currently is not working. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I think we've gotten to a point where there was this big hype about being South African in the 1990s. And that has, to an extent,
petered out a bit. Yeah. You could see it. I mean, the amount of fuss made of Mandela Day on Monday was kind of, it was like a whimper. It wasn't like it used to be before. And he used to be the central figure around which we built our national identity.
When we started, the reason I started with the question that says, what does the ideal look like, right? Is I kind of think, on one side of the spectrum, you separate and minorities. We spoke earlier in the last hour about the Khoisan, who have been, and when we talk about minorities in South Africa, you know, we have to look at it in terms of what constitutes a minority, you know, where there is a huge drive around a lot of the cases that AfriForum does make a noise about is Afrikaans, for instance, and whether I don't even know what his name is right now, from the MEC for Education in Gauteng has a problem with Afrikaans and Afrikaans schools and having Afrikaans as a language in schools. And at the same time, I ask myself, you know, where do we draw the line, and at which point do we move to an ideal, and what does that ideal look like without wanting to hark back to what it used to be? Because it's romantic sometimes to look backwards, right? And you know, we talk about the Khoisan, and I was thinking about the Lubedu. I'm sure you know about the Lubedu. And their language doesn't even exist in the languages that are South African languages, whereas Afrikaans is the third most spoken language after Zulu and Xhosa in South Africa, right? So how do you divide it up?
I mean, Pums, this is a really good question. It's something I've often tangled with because people like to make it so simplified, and we're not a simplified country. We're very complex. And Ernst, maybe you can also shed some light on this. How granular do we get when it comes to dividing ourselves up? Is it language? Is it culture? Is it tribal identity? Is it historicity, you know, kind of when, who came where? And is it geographical even? Because we look at provinces that are completely mixed up. I mean, it used to be that the Free State, mostly you could speak Afrikaans and Sesotho and people would understand you. That's not true anymore. In Gauteng, it used to be mostly, I suppose, in the early part of the last century, mostly Setswana, Afrikaans, and maybe a little bit of English. Now, I would say predominantly Sizulu is spoken in most of the townships of Gauteng. So how would you figure that? How do you, because if you get too granular, it's not a nation anymore. Then we may as well just separate into a bunch of provinces and become balkanized.
Yeah, so the early philosophers who spoke about the state or who sort of laid the groundwork for what we now call the modern state, people like Thomas Hobbes and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and so forth, they spoke about, and John Locke as well to an extent, spoke about the artificial community. And the natural community as opposed to the artificial community. And what they meant by that is that the state is an artificial community, and they meant it as a good thing. So it's this new thing that we're building, and particularly not only the state, the statist identity. So we're building the state, and now your identity is defined by the state. And South Africa is a good example. We become South Africans. We weren't South Africans in the past. We had different identities, and now we have the South African government, and now we are South Africans. And there was this whole thing about supplanting the natural community with an artificial community. That's, again, that's how they framed it. So your natural identity could be things like your religious identity, your cultural identity, the thing that you naturally think of yourself as, or used to think of yourself as in the past. And I think part of the problem here is that there's also the word artificial is a strange word for them to use, because to me it's a negative term. And I think there's a negative spin-off in precisely that, is when you deal with an artificial community, or when you deal with the idea that South Africa is a very diverse country, but we found this state, we become South Africans. We're all not necessarily all the same, but we all have a lot of things in common, and we need to focus on that. The moment you start pushing that through in laws, in legislation, it creates friction on ground sure. level, because you implement things that people don't necessarily think are important. And so to get to your question, I don't think the answer lies in having more legislation, or having not even more legislation, having legislation to define how do we identify ourselves, or how should we structure society. The answer should be in a more organic approach, so that people can decide for themselves. And people have multiple identities. I mean, I'm part of the Afrikaans-speaking community, but I'm also part of the Afrikaner community, which are two different things. The one is a language community, the other one is a cultural community. Hmm. But I'm also a Christian. And there are many people who are Christians who would say that they are not Afrikaners, they don't associate with that. But I'm also South African. So you can have multiple identities. And I think when we get to a point where different identities compete with each other, or the one is what one identity experiences that it's being under pressure from another one, because we're being told that in South Africa, you can be Afrikaans.
But isn't that inevitable? Yeah. I mean, isn't human interaction anywhere in the world inevitably going to result in friction, because people rub up against each other? You can see it in neighborhoods. Like, your tree hangs over your neighbor's garden, and there's an issue, you know? So these are things that we have to learn to deal with. Are we going to give up on the South African project? Because, yes, our borders are completely artificial. I mean, you know, people who are Ndebele in South Africa are Matabele in Zimbabwe, but that's an artificial border that was set up by, you know, countries that have long ago evacuated and left this continent from a power point of view. How do we figure the way forward, though, Ernst? Because you guys are standing up for your community, and that is laudable. I don't think anyone in the world would say there's anything wrong with that. And you go around and you explain the position of Afrikaans people and of minorities in South Africa. And you've also, as AfriForum, done some work for other minorities who are not Afrikaans and white. I understand that. But where do we draw the line? Like, Pumi and I are just a bit confused, and I think a lot of people are, as to what the ideal would be. Is it a totally devolved state where it's all so granular that people really just form little enclaves, and those enclaves don't have anything to do with each other, and it's almost like an anarchic system where local authorities are, it's almost tribal. I mean, like, that's kind of the ultimate extreme on the one side. And the other one is, we have this big central government, we're told what South Africa is, and we all just have to fit in or fuck off. I mean, which one is it?
Yeah, that's a good point. So firstly, my reference to pressure and friction is not that we should try to have a system where there's no friction. Friction is also a good thing. But the concern is this links back to the point about federalism in the beginning, is you have a degree of friction in society, which is normal, and you have, you know, contradicting opinions and contradicting, you can even call it identities, or things that sprout from different identities that contradict each other. But the problem is now when you have a strong central government that decides on behalf of society as a whole what is right and what is wrong, and then captures that in legislation. We are Democrats and we're very much in favor of democracy, but we need to remember there's a difference between democracy is not just simply everyone can vote. Democracy is much more than that. Democracy is we often say the test of whether democracy is a well-functioning democracy is more than just do people have rights and can people vote. The test is also do minority communities who are not sufficiently represented or properly represented in parliament or do not have political authority or power, rather, do they also feel that they are protected? And I think, and I'm not just speaking for about Afrikaners, I think minority communities in general in South Africa feel that they're not protected. But I want to make a point about your second comment there, because that's, yes, you want to
yeah,
add on.
I want to say about, and Gareth, I think you understand me and what I'm trying to understand about AfriForum, right? But a lot of it seems very amoebous, right? Kind of really not quite definable as in, and it's just reminding me of, and there are two things. One, when we talk about representation, and this is why I'm a big fan of the way that our constitution is, and also the way that we have proportional representation in parliament versus a winner takes all, is that actually we have proportional representation. Even if you are not the outright winner of the election, you still get to have representation proportional to the number of votes that you were able to get. You know, so there is a representation available for everyone.
It's built in. It's built in. It's baked into the cake.
But that's why that is why our constitution kind of gets the admiration that it does all over the world, because it gives credence to all of those varying parts. But I just also listening to this undefinable kind of what is the minority, what is the function, where are we, is reminding me of, and funny, it was first published in 1908 by Churchill, wrote a book called My African Journey. In it, he writes about white men in Africa, his experience, because he traveled on the continent as a young man before he became a statesman. And one of the things that he says there as he's traveling around is there's this sense, and his quote is, there is a sense every white man seems to feel a sense of undefinable oppression. And that's what I'm hearing here. It's undefinable, this oppression that you, and I'm kind of feeling a little bit like we need to talk about other things because we can't define it, and it's kind of moving and amorphous. The world is on fire. I said this in the last hour. There are so many things, and I think that the world has turned upside down. And one of the things that I'm quite interested to know is AfriForum's view and stance with Mkhwebane, for instance, with what's happening with Mkhwebane in parliament and the impeachment process.
Let's get into specifics.
25 questions to the president.
Let's go to that because I think that's quite important. I mean, Ernst, you and Pumi and I could probably talk about political philosophy and ideology and, you know, the kinds of political systems. We could talk for hours. I don't know that it'll interest anybody but the three of us. So let's get to some specifics because I think we've given this enough legroom. Tell us about Busisiwe Mkhwebane and your position on her, because I think she has become a major carbuncle on the political landscape, and she's just not moving. She's also getting support from some strange areas. What do you make of it?
I just want to make one quick comment about the undefinable thing, because I don't think what AfriForum is doing is hard to define at all.
Okay.
I can define it in one sentence, and that's AfriForum is an inclusive Afrikaner organization that seeks to build mutual recognition and respect between different communities, and that seeks to decentralize, to have a more decentralized political system in South Africa. In terms of the public protector, it's been an ongoing issue. And it's not only the public protector, it's the Chapter 9 institutions in general, I think, have become quite problematic in the sense that it goes back to this issue about the Constitution as well. And I want to make it specific, but I think there's a broader picture issue here is we have a fantastic constitution if you read the text, but then if you look at what's the reality in South Africa or how it's being implemented, then suddenly we bump into a lot of problems. And the irony here is that the public protector is one of the better functioning Chapter 9 institutions. There are other institutions that are just completely absent. They get money from government, but there's just nothing happening, like the Section 185 institution commission, which is supposed to work for different communities, religious, cultural communities, and so forth. In terms of the public protector, I think the issue here is that we have a government that, it seems fairly easy that for the problem to be dealt with. And I'm not going to say if she should be fired or shouldn't be fired, but the thing is here that it should not be this difficult for a president to deal with, or a government or a cabinet to deal with. But the issue here is we have a ruling party that is so mixed up in internal friction, and it's basically falling apart, or at least on the verge of falling apart. And people who are in positions of power within the ruling party, who are also in positions of power in the South African government, have to be first and foremost concerned about managing things so that their party don't fall apart. And now we've reached some form of a deadlock where if you make some form of a decision, we're on the verge of the ruling party falling apart.
So on that note, what do you think of the president's leadership over the last while, and where his priorities lie?
Well, he made a comment before he became president when he was campaigning during some speech at a rally where he said that he would rather be, and those were his words, not mine, he said that he would rather be a weak president than to be president over an ANC that splits or that divides. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, he's keeping his promise, because I really do think his main priority is to keep the ruling party from breaking up. And there's some serious concerns that it might break up, and there's some serious concerns that it might lose, there's some serious internal friction. And so he's in this deadlock at the moment where he just doesn't seem to be able to make decisions. And when he makes a decision, it's almost always that we have to establish a commission to advise us, or some committee.
We need there a discussion. We need a conversation. It's let's talk some more.
Yeah. There was an infographic that was doing the rounds on social media, like a time table, you could say, of when did he become president and what were the major decisions he's taken, especially when it comes to commissions. And I can't remember the amount. There must have been more than a dozen commissions or advisory panels. Sorry?
25.
That's it.
Currently.
Yeah. And so there's an issue about the commissions as well, where, we could talk about the Zondo Commission, for example. There's a debate, I've been having a debate with some colleagues, which I think was very, very intriguing, as to is this a good thing or not? And the reason why the Zondo Commission is a good thing is because there's a proper investigation into what's happening with state capture and what's happening with corruption. And these things that nobody knew about are suddenly coming to the fore,
right,
and people are taking notice. But the reason why it's a bad thing is...
I must just warn you, Ernst, you are talking to Pumi, who is the only person who's read all the state capture reports from beginning to end.
Oh.
She's an expert on them, and she's my only reference point when it comes to the Zondo Commission.
I'll gladly stand corrected. But the reason why it's a bad thing is I think a lot of these people could have been prosecuted before. It wasn't necessary to have a commission to prosecute a lot of these people. And now that the commission has done its work, the question is, will they be prosecuted in any case?
Right.
And so establishing the point that I'm trying to make is establishing some form of a government commission or advisory panel. I think we've gotten to the point where it becomes an excuse not to take action. You don't want to make a decision, so you establish a commission.
Yeah.
And yes, there's a good argument as to why the commission is, particularly the Zondo Commission, was a good thing. But we don't see political leadership in this country. We just see commissions and advisory panels.
Yeah, well, it started, we set the pace the way that we started with the TRC. So we started our country with the commission, which set the tone for how we go on. And I was reading a very fascinating article a couple of days ago that's actually, I read it in the Atlantic, so it's not, but it references South Africa too. about the dilemma of white liberals in particular in America and in South Africa. It talks about, we started like that. We set out a commission to kind of ventilate all of these things, and then there was no holding to account.
By and large,
there was no holding to account. In other countries, in Germany, in a week and a half ago in Mexico, I think, they're trying 93-year-old men for, you know, people were held to account, people were taken through a trial, people were hanged and shot for the atrocities of what, but we created a country that starts with a commission that then doesn't hold anybody to account. And so we are just carrying on in that way, you know, so that's just the thing. But I do want to say, you know, the issue, there are a couple of issues that you're raising, Ernst, and the thing about Mkhwebane for me is this is absolutely the right thing, right? She is sitting as a Chapter 9 institution, not being held to account by the executive, which would largely be the president and the ANC and all of their factional stuff, but by parliament. And the parliamentary commission before which she sits is, that's why I was saying, you know, that we have a representative parliament. That parliamentary committee that she's sitting in is representative of all of the parties that are sitting in parliament. So it's not just the ANC that's asking questions, that's going to make this decision. That committee is an, you know, this is where your parliamentarian, and we were talking about it last week, and I said, you know, it's sad that we, the people, have relegated our responsibility so much, we don't even know who our parliamentary representatives are. I remember, Helen Suzman, when she was in parliament, used to be called the honorable representative of Houghton. We don't know who the
they are.
And you should be able to identify that person so that you can phone them up and hold them to account. Then you know, as they sit in that parliamentary committee, that this AfriForum representative comes, not AfriForum representative, FF representative, I'm sorry about that, Ernst, is coming from, is the parliamentarian who is the representative of Orania.
Exactly.
So that you can phone them up, you can go to the constituency office and hold them accountable. We have allowed that to be. We've let the ANC take control and wag the dog, essentially.
Well, it sounds, I hate to say this, but just from the observer's point of view, it does sound like there's quite a lot of common ground here. And I think a lot of South Africans are very pissed off with the current state of affairs, which is probably advantageous to an organization like AfriForum. Have you seen a surge in support? Just as a very quick yes or no answer, because I think...
Yes. Definitely.
All right. So, guys, in the interests of finding something we can disagree about more heartily, because people like that on the show, and I'm not doing what they do on the morning shows in America where they, you know, bring two people on who have different opinions. Let's talk about the international stuff, because I know Ernst has got some really insightful thoughts on what's going on in America, China, what's happening with Russia and the Ukraine. I know Pumi's also very deep in these stories. So let's get into them. Pums, do you want to start with Russia, Ukraine, and maybe we get some insight there from both of you?
Did you see the pictures of not just Russia and Ukraine? I mean, very interesting to see Vladimir Putin with the leader of Iran. Very interesting to see him shaking hands. And for me, it's, we spoke a little bit about this ages ago on the show, is the shifting sands of world politics and where power is beginning to devolve to. You know, so unfortunately, Joe Biden is not doing a great job keeping America at the helm of what they used to call the free world. That power has completely shifted. You know, you see Iran shaking hands with Russia, you see the oil price, and you're like, how's that going to shake up for us?
Well,
you know,
Vladimir Putin said this just yesterday in a press conference. He said, as specialists, he points at the media, you would know that the crisis, the food crisis, emerged from the times of the anti-pandemic measures, where some well-developed countries abused their monopoly power in terms of current monopolies. This is what he said to all those gathered journalists. And he said part of his move on securing those provinces in the Ukraine, which are mostly Russian, is to secure food. And he says that America is now going to become a net importer of food. And he feels that they're in no position to be shouting the odds to the rest of the world. Food security is a part of this discussion, is it not? And Ernst, this brings us back to AfriForum in South Africa and a lot of your representation of farmers, for example, which has a lot to do with our food security. What do you have to say about Russia and Ukraine and Pumi's comments?
Well, it's very interesting what's happening there. And there's a bigger debate to be had about, you know, global politics and how should things be structured. I think it's very unfortunate that it's always difficult to comment about the views of citizens in another country. But I want to talk about America's role, and in the sense that I think America's biggest threat, there's probably a better word, is not so much Russia as it is China. And so the three big global powers are probably, you know, would be America, Russia, and China. And I would have thought that as someone standing on the sideline commenting on American politics, that for the Americans, they would have wanted to probably strengthen ties and relationships with Russia. That didn't happen, I know. And America has a history about the Cold War and all of that. So that's understandable. And I think this is the result of a friction that's been building up for quite some time. And I'm curious about these sanctions also. So I heard, for example, I was in Hungary recently, and when I was there, there was a debate about who should we support the sanctions or not. When I say we, should the Hungarians, they were debating about it. And they actually decided that they're not going to support the sanctions. And the reason why is they figured that the sanctions might hurt Russia, but it's going to hurt Hungary even more. So I think the issue here, and this is not my field of expertise, Russian politics, but the question at least is, to what extent has Russia been, to what extent are they sanction-proof? In other words, in what extent can they withstand sanctions and stuff like that? Or to what extent is this really hurting them and you know, influencing them or swaying them to take a different course of action? I'm not convinced that the way the world is reacting currently is swaying the Russian government, and because I'm not sure if it has that bigger impact as people would like to believe.
You know, but I do think, and just to bring it home a little bit, it's important to understand what's happening in world politics so that we understand how that impacts us. And more than that, what we can do next. For me, that's the most important thing, is looking at how things are and how things are evolving. What do we do next? You know, South Africa is currently sitting very precariously in an environment where we have the highest inflation we've had in almost 16 years, I think the number was. We were talking about the interest rate hikes that are likely to be announced this afternoon. We're looking at petrol prices. I mean, I have to think long and hard. Am I going to drive to the studio because I have no load shedding? Yeah. Or am I going to drive to my office and will there be power? This is like bullshit that we have to think about that. Because it does mean that in a country like South Africa, where we have a 64% unemployment rate, where we have 30 million South Africans living on less than 20 rand a day. What does that mean for us? And how do we change our situation? That is why we're interested in what policies the ruling party propagates in their policy conference that's coming up in a few weeks' time.
What policies
are they talking about? Because those policies, if they win the election in 2024, become national policy.
Right.
I'm also very interested to know what policies is Action SA talking about. We never hear that. What policies is the DA talking about? We never hear that. Because we live in this world that kind of has closed out, is so interested in this manufactured outrage about little things like Angole.
Right? Yeah.
And these are the bigger issues, you know, even as we talk about the thriving or the opportunity for minorities to thrive in South Africa. The truth of the matter is, no minority is going to thrive with those kinds of numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's another lesson from what's happening in Ukraine for minorities in South Africa, and that is that Ukraine have friends who are very far away and they have enemies who are right next door. And it's something to be said. So AfriForum, we're trying to build good relations with you know people all over the world, but there's no point in having good relations with people in America or people in England or the Netherlands or wherever if we don't have good relations in South Africa. It really is a very high priority for AfriForum. Is we talk about bonding and bridging. So bonding is within our own community to show to our members that we are on their side and we do represent them. And when they feel strongly about something, we are going to push this. But when we talk about bridging, we talk about building bridges between communities and working together. And building bridges does not mean we're going to, you know, show up at some other community and tell them, all right, we have the solution, we have the answer, this is what you should be doing. It's about going to another community and listening to them and listening to their experiences and so forth. And so I think that's also an important point. But the point you're making is very valid. I mean, there's an intellectual discussion to be had about Russia and Ukraine, but the fact of the matter is that people are experiencing it on a ground level as well.
Well, Ernst, now you can see why I need Pumi on the show. I mean, if we just cut that little tirade of hers out now, that would probably hit home with more people than anything I've said in the last 3 weeks on the show. No, but it's exactly right. Listen, those numbers are staggering. I mean, the unemployment is just outrageous. You guys are not a political party, but bringing it back home for a second, what can we do to immediately arrest this decline, to immediately stop, in your opinion, as a citizen, not even representative of AfriForum now, as an ordinary guy in society, what are your biggest concerns? What have you put up with in the last while that has annoyed you, frustrated you, made you feel like, you know, South Africa is not something that you can see a future for? And where do you find the positive hope to keep on going and to keep on doing things for the members of AfriForum, even though you're just a citizen?
Yeah, well, I would say there are two things, and they seem contradictory. So the first is the point I've been making earlier is to push for and to become more involved in some form of a decentralized government, that you don't have a government who can just who are not in touch, let's just put it this way, with local communities. But then on the other side, I think another important thing is for people to accept that we cannot wait for government, or we cannot wait for some form of change in government structure or something like that. We need to accept responsibility for where we are and what we can do. And some people can do a lot and some people can do very little. But really pushing, for example, to start a business. And I know it's very difficult to start a business in South Africa also, well, because of the circumstances that Pumi was talking about, but then also because of regulation and things like that. But the overarching point here, and this is probably the main theme in AfriForum, is do something. We have this saying, self doing is better as niks doing. You know, doing something is better than doing nothing. So even if it's very small, whatever you can do within your community, do that very small thing at least. And I think if we can get that attitude, if we can get more people to do whatever they can do, I think that's going to help a lot, regardless of what government is doing.
So what's interesting to me, I know that you had a bit of an incident where you and your family were out eating at a restaurant the other night, and like gunmen came in and your kids were with you and they actually saw some horrible things. I mean, you just want to quickly share that story, because I think it's a story that so many of us can relate to. We're watching this Senzo Meyiwa case going on, which is also filled with violence and ugliness. We hear about, you know, people in taverns in the Eastern Cape who've had to put up with outrageous violence. Soweto, there was an incident just the other day. Yours kind of links into these to just, again, if there's anything that ties us together as South Africans, it's that we've become so used to this stuff.
Yeah, so it was in June, it was my son's birthday, and that evening, sort of impromptu or spontaneously, we said, well, let's go to Spur to have ice cream. You know, if you have a birthday at Spur, they sing for you and all of that. And so we went there. It was evening. It was a weekend. And we paid. And it was, I don't know, 7 o'clock or something. And we got up and we were walking towards the door. And what I didn't know at that moment was that I saw there were people standing at the door, at the entrance, at the pay point. But what I didn't know is they were actually robbing the place. And so as we were walking towards the door, We just heard, started hearing, you know, firearms going off, shots being fired, and people, you know, everyone fell down. We were basically 10 meters, I'd say 10, 20 meters from where they were. And someone was actually shot dead. I didn't know at that stage that it was one of the robbers. And the guy, as we were, I jumped, I had my son, my youngest son, who's 2 years old, in my arms. And we ducked below the table, and the dead body literally fell next to the table, next to us as we were lying there, me and my oldest son. I think what was a bit more alarming for us, I mean, that's very, very horrible. But at that moment, I have four children, and the other two, I have four boys. The other two were playing outside at the play area. My wife thought they were upstairs, because it's a spur with a play area upstairs as well. So she was upstairs just as the shots were being fired. She wanted to run down because there was no one up there. And then people just screamed to her, lie down, fall flat. And she then did that. So she couldn't see anyone. She just heard shots. She heard people screaming, someone is dead. And she didn't know where I was or where the children was. The two boys who were outside then came running into the restaurant. First, the older one asked the 7 years old, asked people outside what's happening. And someone said to them, fall flat, they're shooting inside. Fall down, they're shooting inside. And the other one, the younger one, ran inside. So his brother ran with him inside. And as he came into the door, my wife actually saw him. And she screamed at him to lie down on the floor. He just heard her voice. When I heard her voice, I screamed at her that we're okay. And he then ran towards her. And then the other boy came in and he heard my voice. So he ran towards me. And it was quite scary at that moment because everyone was lying down. There were shots being fired. And the boys were running looking for their parents. But what's particularly bad about that incident is, so I was lying with my 10-year-old boy and my 2-year-old boy under this table next to the dead body. And the body was between us and the door. So eventually we didn't know, we actually thought it was a customer. So we thought they were there just killing customers. Eventually when we got out, you know, we had to step over the dead body to get out of the restaurant. So it had quite an impact on the kids. I mean, you can imagine, especially the older one the 2-year-old didn't understand what was happening. The other two boys understood, but not as well as the older brother. I mean, they've been talking about it ever since all the time. And I know there are people who've had much worse experiences in South Africa. I've spoken with people. There was someone dead at this incident, but my family were unharmed, at least physically. So it gives one a bit of a glimpse into the reality that a lot of people are facing in this country. I'm just glad that we got out okay in that situation.
I think we're all glad that you guys got out okay. And it's horrendous that we live in a society that is this violent, that does have all and with such impunity that there is no way that people get held accountable, you know, that it'll take forever. If ever they're caught, it'll take forever for them to go through the justice system, and it is absolutely horrendous. I'm really sorry that you and your family had to go through this. I'm sorry anybody has to go through this.
Yeah, I'm just glad you told us that story, because often we get into like intellectual discussions around what's right and what's wrong, and then we forget about people's personal experiences. I mean, there are parents all over the country who are grieving about incidents where their children are no longer around. There are just horrible things happening in South Africa, and we have to be realistic about what's attainable. And some of it isn't government's fault. Some of it is just our society that we live in. You know, we like to blame government for a lot of things, and politicians can take a lot of responsibility for some of the disasters around us. But a lot of it is like us having to look in the mirror too, figure out how we're going to get along, how we're going to fix things, and how we're going to coexist peacefully and meaningfully and build something valuable. So I'm glad that you got to share that story with us, because it also just, you tend to be like a lot of people who we see in the news, and someone who's, you know, kind of outside of the reality that so many of us are going through. But I'm glad that you got to explain that, even though it's a horrible, horrible situation that nobody wants to to hear anyone else go through. Anyway, listen, I know you and Pumi and I could talk for hours and hours, but we're out of time for this morning. There's still plenty.
Can I say one thing before we go?
Of course you can.
Can I say just one thing before we go? Because I cannot allow this show to end with such a blatant misrepresentation or misunderstanding in the comments. There's quite a lot happening in the comments.
Yes.
But I just want to address, you know, John Douglas in the comments. I think, John, you are misunderstanding what I'm saying. I'm not saying that the ANC is the only one with policies. I'm simply saying it would be good to hear what other people's policies are, other than the fact that they are anti-ANC, because it gives us all an opportunity to interrogate what people stand for, other than being anti-ANC.
Right.
It was like Jacob Zuma. Get rid of Jacob Zuma, and then what?
Mm-hmm.
Here we are. We got rid of Jacob Zuma. Has our life become better? Has the world changed? Has, you know, because if you have one thing in mind without a plan going forward, you're still going to be fucked. That's it. Thank you. Another tirade. That is a tirade.
So Pumi's
the quote for the interview.
Well, there's a lot from Pumi this morning. Ernst, always good to have you on, and thank you very much for joining us. We will talk to you again soon, and keep us informed as to what you guys are up to.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show. It was great talking to you.
Ernst Rutz from AfriForum, Pumi Mashiqo, and we will see you tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Have an excellent Thursday. CliffCentral.com